From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Medicaid expansion has dominated North Carolina's political debate in recent years. We'll learn about a new report that challenges a key claim from expansion's proponents. The report says Medicaid expansion will not help keep rural hospitals afloat. Economic freedom sounds like a good concept. The more you learn about the impact of economic freedom, the better it sounds. We'll chat with an international expert on the topic. When Mark Johnson decided to run for another statewide office, he guaranteed North Carolina would have a new superintendent of public instruction in 2021. We'll take a look at the race for that post. You'll learn about the candidates, Democrat Jen Mangrum and Republican Catherine Truitt. North Carolina, along with the rest of the world, is dealing with the coronavirus. You'll hear some highlights from news briefings about the state's initial response. And speaking of the coronavirus, Donna Martinez addresses that topic in the Carolina Journal headline.
The outbreak of the coronavirus has focused the public on access to quick, effective, and affordable medical care. Right now, there are some barriers in place that prevent that goal from being achieved, barriers that state officials right here in North Carolina could, and in some cases are, actually eliminating. Jordan Roberts is healthcare policy analyst with the John Locke Foundation. He's been looking into all of these aspects as we deal with the coronavirus. He joins us now with some recommendations. Jordan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
One thing that has struck me is the issue of, well, people wanting to practice social distancing, mm-hmm. stay inside their homes mm-hmm. if they're having some sort of symptoms, but people also want to have access to a nurse or a doctor. Mm-hmm. That has really brought the spotlight onto something you've written about for many, many, many months. That is telemedicine.
That's right. Yeah. So, you know, I just want to say one thing first, just a special thank you to all the people in the healthcare system that are working tirelessly to, you know, deal with this impending crisis. So just want to give a shout out to all of them because it couldn't be done without them. But yes, telemedicine, you know, we've talked a lot about it. It's becoming more and more commonly used, and especially with a case, virus like this that's very contagious, and it's, we don't really have a lot of idea of where it's spreading to and where cases are coming from. So a lot of the recommendations have been to distance yourself socially from people. That means, you know, minimizing as much contact as to not spread this disease, because even though you might not have symptoms, you might not be affected, you could spread it to other people who may. So telemedicine has been recommended by a lot of the top public health officials as one way to, you know, limit the amount of contact that someone may have. And then, you know, what it does is it supplements, you know, the normal routine of care. By, you know, if someone needs a diagnosis, they can, you know, use a video conferencing to get more information that could, you know, better inform their decision of whether I truly need to go to the urgent care or whether I can stay home and isolate myself. So, you know, it just helps, people inform their decisions better. And, it's in line with all the public health recommendations of distancing.
It wasn't too long ago that, at least for me, the thought of using my smartphone or my laptop computer to access medical advice or medical care was, mm-hmm. I had never thought of that, Jordan.
Right.
But this thing has really advanced a lot.
Absolutely.
And in a way, the fact that we're having this crisis of the coronavirus really has made people understand that this can have a really positive impact and help people, that it doesn't just need to be an innovation that we use as a last resort, but this
right.
could be a first resort.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we're trying to, you know, flesh out all the diagnosed cases and, when people actually need to go get tested and get treatment. So, you know, telemedicine can really help us by better allocating the resources and directing, you know, people more better information to, make their decision on what to do here.
But here's the problem. Evidently, because of licensure rules, we're not able at this point to access any doctor, any mm-hmm. nurse that we would like to see. Tell us about that.
That's right. So, current regulations in North Carolina right now stipulate that if you are a patient accessing care through telemedicine, that doctor that you see has to be licensed in North Carolina. And so we know there's plenty of doctors, all well-qualified, highly trained doctors all around the country right now that are willing to, you know, offer their diagnosis and services through telemedicine means, but we can't do that in North Carolina right now. So that's one of the recommendations we see, to just increase the access to diagnosis and information from well-qualified doctors. We can waive these regulations to allow people in North Carolina to see someone that doesn't have a North Carolina license, because once again, just when you cross a state barrier doesn't mean the quality of medical care goes down anymore. And, you know, we should just open this up to, you know, allow as many people to assist in this pandemic as possible. And so, you know, CVS MinuteClinic offers a $59 video visit to one of their licensed physicians or nurse practitioners, but that service isn't available here in North Carolina. And, you know, this is just one of the ways we see to help people access the healthcare system now, very affordable pricing, and, you know, get information that can help them better make this decision.
And as more people are diagnosed and we're seeing closures, et cetera, at least at the time that you and I are speaking, we're mm-hmm. still at the point where we're seeing increasing numbers of cases across the country and mm-hmm. across the world. It is putting an especially difficult burden on medical professionals. I'm so That's glad right. you gave them the shout out, because mm-hmm. this is one of those times where something that we just take for granted
exactly.
really comes into the spotlight as being essential.
Mm-hmm.
So, Jordan, how do we make sure that we have enough access to care and affordable care, particularly if you look at some of the hospitals? They have a limited number mm-hmm. of doctors, a limited number of surgery centers or hospital mm-hmm. beds, et cetera. And the state of North Carolina is realizing that this is a question as well. Tell us what the issue is.
Right. So in North Carolina, we're a certificate of need state, meaning in order to expand beds or expand a facility, buy something new, you usually need permission from the government. So in, you know, something like this where we have a virus spreading and cases are going to come up suddenly, we might, you know, there might be a case where a hospital needs to make quick decisions on transforming beds and to treat these folks, or increasing beds, or, you know, just making quick decisions on the ground based on what's happening in front of them. And, you know, these certificate of need laws would get in the way, because anything above a 10% increase in your beds, you would have to get permission from the state from. But last night we saw Health and Human Services Secretary Mandy Cohen talked about that they're working with the state to get these laws waived, so that if a hospital did need to increase their beds by more than 10%, they would be able to do that without, you know, spending resources, getting permission from the state. So we're happy to see that that's happened. Obviously, you know, here at the John Locke Foundation, we think certificate of need law should be repealed. And, you know, in a situation like this, it kind of highlights that reason that we should trust the medical providers, the private actors on the ground, to make these decisions based on what they're seeing, as opposed to someone in Raleigh. So, you know, we're glad to see that, because we just want to make sure that these providers and hospitals are able to treat these patients however they see fit, you know, no matter what situation might come up in front of them.
Once we have this virus contained and taken care of, and we get through the immediate issue here, and we start looking back, mm-hmm. and let's hope that that's very, very soon, of
Agreed.
Course. But once we start looking back, it could be a really interesting light bulb moment, mm-hmm. a lessons learned moment, as we
sure.
look at those barriers and really the different things that we can do mm-hmm. here at the state level, not waiting for the federal government or relying on the federal government in terms of rules and regulations, where we can actually do things. And if it ends up helping people in a crisis situation, maybe we can all come to the agreement that we should just leave it this way. Let those people on the ground make those decisions as they need to.
Right. You know, and we talk about certificate of need laws and license reciprocity, you know, recognizing out-of-state licenses to come in and treat North Carolina patients in a time of crisis and emergency. And, you know, I've written about this before. If we trust them in a time of emergency, why wouldn't we trust them, you know, other times? And, you know, these are licensed, well-qualified physicians in good standing. And so, you know, just to increase access and just to give the as much power to the private actors, the individuals making these decisions on the ground, we think is, you know, the right direction to go.
Well, Jordan, you've been doing some really interesting writing on this as we have seen this virus situation grow. And folks, you can read all of his work at carolinajournal.com and also johnlock.org, the different aspects of medical care, mm-hmm. affordability, access, and things like that. And Jordan, thanks so much for joining us to talk about all of this.
Yep, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Jordan Roberts is the healthcare policy analyst for the John Locke Foundation. Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly. But our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Medicaid expansion has served as one of the key political issues in North Carolina politics. Governor Roy Cooper and legislative Democrats favor expansion. Republican legislative leaders oppose it. A recent study from the Foundation for Government Accountability, or FGA, adds more evidence to the debate. Joining us now to discuss that study is Roy Leonardson. He is Government Affairs Director at FGA. Thanks for joining us.
Well, it's good to be here. Thank you for having me. And, you know, and I should add, Jordan Roberts at right here at your organization, John Locke, was also the co-author of our latest study. So we actually teamed up with you guys right here in North Carolina. And, you know, FGA is based out of Florida. We work in over 30 states, 501c3, but, we partner with groups, particularly groups like you guys, which we value the input. So it's actually co-branded.
Aha. Well, the Medicaid study, obviously, this is something that's been a part of our politics,
that's right.
A key issue. And now your study is saying that, at least in terms of how it affects hospitals, Medicaid expansion is not all it's cracked up to be.
Yeah, you know, here's what's interesting. As the data starts to roll in here, we're 4 or 5 years into this, it's one piece of bad news after another for the folks that have expanded Medicaid. So if you look at it, it's almost like the four horsemen of the apocalypse here when it comes to Medicaid expansion. One is the enrollments are more than 100% off in the states that expanded it. So if you said you were going to have 100 people, you ended up having 200 people in your states. And unfortunately, when it is more like they said 200,000, they ended up having 400,000. And so every single solitary state that has expanded Medicaid has been off by a factor of more than 100% for the most part, some even much larger than that. So the enrollment numbers are wrong. So that's sort of the horse number one.
And when the enrollment numbers are wrong, it's not just there are more people, but
it's the second horse. It bankrupts budgets. What we like to say is it almost Pac-Mans your budget. So think of things that you care about here in North Carolina. Your roads, your great university education, your top-notch K-12 education, bridges, public safety, you know, taking care of your environment, your beaches, the mountains. I mean, North Carolina has it all. Where do you think the money comes from to pay for Medicaid? It literally eats the other pieces of the budget. So, you know, we've seen in some states where the Medicaid budget now consumes almost 35% of the state budget. And so more than, you know, typically a state budget will be about 20% education. That's what's happened. It used to be 20% Medicaid, then higher education. That's reversed. So it's literally eating your budget alive. And there's nothing you could do because once you expand Medicaid, you're beholden to the federal government. So you've got the enrollment explosion. You've got the cost explosion. The other absolutely dreadful thing this does that folks don't realize is that if you earn between 100 and 138% of poverty, okay, $16,000, $17,000 a year, you are eligible to be on the Obamacare Exchange, which is a totally different federal program, for free, or maybe 10 bucks a month, depending on your income, but very minimal. That is private insurance. Okay, so if you're right now in North Carolina, if you're between 100 and 138% of poverty, you're not on Medicaid, you're on private health care for $10 a month. If you pass Medicaid expansion in North Carolina, those people, and there are tens of thousands of them here in their state, are no longer eligible for the private insurance program. They are forced onto the welfare program. So I want you, people need to understand that. You are literally condemning tens of thousands of North Carolinians who right now have insurance on the in the private sector, paid for by the federal government with a small subsidy. It's against the law. You can't be on it. You are kicked off immediately and transferred to a Medicaid program, which is inferior insurance. Okay? It's medical welfare. The other one is private insurance. So that's the third thing. You kick off people and condemn them to a life of welfare. And you know what the only requirement is? Stay poor. And that is, does not seem to be the kind of message that you want to be sending. The other issue here is, what does this do to your economy? You have over 250,000 open jobs right now over in North Carolina. More than 40% of those open jobs provide insurance. You don't need able-bodied adults to stay poor and stay home. You need able-bodied adults to get off the couch and go to work. Medicaid expansion has the exact opposite effect of that.
Yeah, bad incentives there. Bad incentives.
It removes the incentive to go to work. So it's really dreadful. And so to get to the newest information and Jordan and Nick's report on hospitals, I think one of the things y'all have been hearing is that this will save hospitals, particularly rural hospitals. That is a bald-faced lie. I would encourage folks to go to your website or the FGA.org and read this report. It is not a silver bullet for hospitals. Rural hospitals are continuing to close at an even greater clip in the expansion states. And not to get too wonky, but here's the problem. When you put people on Medicaid and they walk through the front door of your hospital, they're paying between 60 and 75 cents on the dollar of the cost. So every single person on Medicaid that walks through the door, that hospital loses money on that person. That's not a success model. And what happened is, I told you earlier, remember I told you all those people who got kicked off of private insurance and onto Medicaid? Well, people may not know this, but the private insurance folks, they're paying 150 to 250% of the costs. Okay, so they're subsidizing the other group. When you get rid of all these people who are private pay and put them on public pay, it's a double whammy, right? You're losing all that money. And then the other thing that happens is the usage skyrockets. So hospitals are then become inundated and can't afford to do business. And they're losing money. I mean, Colorado, you should look at the reports. Vermont, it doesn't matter the state. If you expanded Medicaid, your rural hospitals are closing and you're losing money. That's the key takeaway. And I think that's one of the most frustrating things, because hospitals are important to communities. I would argue that hospitals are actually not, the building is not important. It's the doctor, the nurse practitioner, the physician assistant, the nurses, the CNAs, all the folks that provide direct care are important. And so maybe rural areas are going to have to think about, are we in a big brick building, or are we sort of doing it the old way that we did it, in someone's in a small facility or a smaller clinic? So I think there's a way to provide health care. The Medicaid debate is not the one to have. It's not going to help.
Some people who've been following this debate will say, well, there's some pros and some cons of Medicaid expansion. If they listen to what you're saying, they're going to say, wait a minute, it sounds like it's all con, no pro.
Listen, these people are poverty peddlers. Don't forget that. They need people on welfare to establish their value. It's not about the value of the human being, the dignity of going to work and having a job and earning a paycheck and supporting your family. Their value outcome is, how many more people can we put on welfare or food stamps, right? The American dream is built on work. There's no other way to spend it. It is not built on a government handout. You know, ask yourself and the folks listening a very simple question. What would you be more proud of, your first welfare check or your first paycheck? That's the question for folks in North Carolina need to answer. Do you want to condemn someone to a life of dependency, or do you want to put someone on the path to the American dream? The American dream is built one paycheck at a time, not one welfare check at a time.
Well, once again, the new study shows that Medicaid expansion does not have the promised increase or impact, positive impact on hospital jobs. That report coming from the Foundation for Government Accountability and the John Locke Foundation. We've been speaking with Roy Leonardson. He is Government Affairs Director for FGA. Thanks so much for joining us.
That's great to be here, and thank you.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina continues to respond to the coronavirus. On the day Governor Roy Cooper declared a state of emergency, his State Health and Human Services Secretary, Mandy Cohen, answered questions from lawmakers. Republican Representative Hugh Blackwell wanted clarification about who's most at risk.
You basically said it's the elderly, 65 and older, and you made reference also to having underlying health problems. To what extent is everybody over 65 theoretically at risk just by virtue of being in the elderly category as compared to their also having an underlying condition? In other words, if we've got folks that are 65 and 70 but otherwise healthy, do they need to sort of start limiting their going out and around? Just because you're old, you're a little unpredictable.
If you look at the CDC guidance, they list it as an or, meaning either you're, they say older adults. We define that more specifically because I like precision. I wanted to know what older meant, and we looked at the data, and for us, older meant 65 and above. That could mean different things depending on the epidemic, but for us, it meant 65 and older, or those chronic diseases. Now, that also means if you're 65 and you have those, yes, I think your risk goes up even more. So, right, and this is why folks need to make their own personal decisions about what is right for them, for their family. They may be someone who doesn't fall into that category, but lives at home with someone that is of that category. So bringing home the virus is just as concerning as anything else. So everyone needs to be using good judgment. There is not perfect information here, and it's going to evolve quickly. Right now we're targeting high-risk folks. That could change. We could say that there are more populations we want to be sure to be protective of. These are guidelines. Use your best judgment.
Blackwell also wanted to know about the scale of the state's response.
As the department is planning for this and you're thinking about more cases, what does more mean? Does it mean twice seven or does it mean 1,000 times 7?
I think it's a fantastic question, and all I can do is look at some of the places that have been impacted earlier. I'm looking at how quickly, let's say, Italy went from having 600 cases to being on full countrywide lockdown, 11 days.
That's State Health and Human Services Secretary Mandy Cohen answering questions about North Carolina's response to the coronavirus. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Economic freedom sounds like a good concept. The more you learn about it, the better it sounds. And here to help us learn about economic freedom and to discuss the implications for North Carolina is Fred McMahon. He is Dr. Michael A. Walker Chair of Economic Freedom Research at the Fraser Institute. That organization compiles rankings of economic freedom. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here in North Carolina.
First of all, before we get into the rankings and what they say, when we're talking about economic freedom, what are we talking about?
Economic freedom is basically the ability of individuals and families to make their own economic decisions free of crony capitalist greed and free of overly ambitious government. So it means relatively low taxes. When government expropriates your property, it reduces your economic freedom. John Locke would have a lot to say about that, his view on property. It means relatively low government spending, even if the money comes from somewhere else, because the more government spends, the less room there is for free exchange. It means a sound legal system and sound property rights. That's probably the most important aspect of economic freedom, less so in North America or Europe, but in developing countries where they struggle with it, because without that, the rich and the powerful abuse their position to gather more riches and wealth. You should be able to trade with the world, and regulation should be low and in place only when necessary. Otherwise, it blocks your freedom to do things.
Sounds like the bottom line is something along the lines of making sure that people get to control as much of the income that they generate or the wealth that they have as possible.
That's true, but with the other aspect that they have more freedom to generate that income and that wealth by not having to face bizarre and onerous regulations, for example.
So tell us about how your institute puts together rankings that show just how well states, provinces in Canada, nations, how well they do on economic freedom.
Sure. We have several indexes, but two significant ones. Economic Freedom of the World, where we rank 162 jurisdictions, and Economic Freedom of North America, where we rank the Mexican states, the U.S. states, and the Canadian provinces. We use only third-party data because it's so easy to have subjective opinions on such things, and those will affect your rankings no matter how much you try to avoid it. So we use only third-party data, and we look at how much government spends, how much government at the state level, how much government taxes, and labor regulations at the state level.
And in coming together with all of the data, then you end up, as we said, ranking ranking the agencies. Do you think that this ranking proves helpful for people to see just how well their country stacks up against others or how well their state stacks up against others?
It's immensely helpful on the international area. I was in Lebanon last week where a free market group is using the index to promote economic freedom in Lebanon. After that, I was in Bosnia, where again, a local free market group is doing the same. Cote d'Ivoire, South Africa, Namibia. I have probably been to about 20 nations where local free market groups turn to the Fraser Institute's Economic Freedom of the World to judge how their nation is doing and to see where the reforms are necessary. Economic Freedom of North America is more recent. The signal at the state level, because of course you're part of a nation, is a little bit more muted. But yes, this has been referred to in the congressional record, in any number of state houses. Free market institutes across the United States, like yours, like the John Locke Foundation, use it to talk to their legislators. Why aren't the people in our state as free as the neighboring states?
Economic freedom in and of itself sounds like a good thing, but economic freedom from your research correlates very well with some other things that we should like, doesn't it?
Yes. When the project was getting underway, Milton Friedman, who with Michael Walker and Rose Friedman basically coordinated the project, he said that economic freedom was an intrinsic right that people deserved to have, whether it made their lives better off or not. But he also said he didn't think it would endure unless it did make people's lives better off. Let me just say this. Look around the world, and look at the nations that are doing well and those that are doing poorly. There is no nation without free markets that has a stable democracy. There is no nation without free markets that has a high level of prosperity, except maybe petro states. There is no nation without a high level of economic freedom that protects other rights and freedoms. And this is the social dynamics are complicated, but basically, if you're free economically, then you can explore other freedoms and insist on your other rights.
How about North Carolina? Where do we stack up today, or at least in the latest data that you have, compared to other states in the United States?
North Carolina is around 15th right now, just looking at the state level. Interestingly, it's had some ups and downs in our index.
So among the better states, but not among the very top.
Exactly right.
In looking at the subcategories that you use, what are the ones that stand out to you?
Well, we use three subcategories to look at subnational governments. Government spending, taxation, and labor market freedom. North Carolina does not do great on either government spending or on taxation. So you're around 25th. In other words, a little bit below your overall rank. And you're higher in your overall rank because you do very well in labor market freedom.
in general, when you talk to folks in the state level and they're asking, well, what could we do to make our economic freedom ranking better? What are some of the things that they should be looking at?
Lower government spending, leaving more space for free market exchange. And of course, the flip side of that is lower taxes. When you take a lot of money out of the economy, you discourage people from going there, but you also discourage in investment. Now, a lot of states have problems with labor market freedom. So for instance, you'll have minimum wage laws that stop the poorest and the least educated from participating in the workforce, which is a tragedy. You'll have unions attempting to control the labor market marketplace. And we also measure the size of government employment. If government employs too many people, again, you're taking them out of the free marketplace.
Do you see signs that some agencies and government officials look at this report, find ways that they can make improvements, and then do it?
No legislature is going to say, we did this because the Canadian think tank told us to do this. But we have heard that it's a very powerful tool in talking to legislatures.
Well, that Canadian think tank is the Fraser Institute. Its chair of economic freedom research is Fred McMahon. We thank you so much for joining us.
A pleasure to be here.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Who will be North Carolina's next head of public schools? Well, the field is now set, and either Democrat Jen Mangrum or Republican Catherine Truitt will be elected by North Carolina voters in November. But beyond who will lead the Department of Public Instruction, what impact will they actually have, and what should they try to pursue? For that, we turn to Dr. Terry Stoops. He is Vice President of Research, also the Director of Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. Terry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
First of all, let's talk about the two candidates a bit. Tell us first about Democrat Jen Mangrum.
Yeah, Dr. Mangrum is a professor at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro, and her specialty is reading research, and she has been a professor there for some time. She's a former public school teacher, and she ran unsuccessfully against Phil Berger for his state Senate seat 2 years ago. So that's really where she came on the scene, and she has beat out the field of Democratic opponents to be their candidate for superintendent.
On the Republican side, the candidate who won the primary is Catherine Truitt. Tell us about Catherine Truitt.
Catherine is the chancellor at Western Governors University, North Carolina. That's an online university, a fairly new one here in the state. She's a former classroom teacher, also former advisor to Governor Pat McCrory. So she has been in North Carolina policy circles for a few years, stepped out for a short while, serving in her capacity as chancellor, and is now back on the scene.
Let's talk about what will come once one of those two women is elected in the fall. There has been conversation for years. You and I have talked about it on this program. You've written extensively about it. The issue of the murkiness of how public education is actually governed in North Carolina. So this is a statewide elected office, Superintendent of Public Instruction. How much influence and power does that office and the person who holds it actually have?
Well, no one really knows. And that really is the problem, is that there have been numerous proposals to turn this into an appointed position, either appointed by the General Assembly or the governor or even members of the State Board of Education, as a way to try to get a little more idea of who is ultimately accountable for public schools. But it's a statewide elected position with two primary functions. The first is to serve as the secretary of the State Board of Education. That's a non-voting role, essentially, as an advisor to the State Board of Education. And just as a reminder, the State Board of Education is a 11-member appointed board, along with the lieutenant governor and the treasurer, and they're appointed by the governor. But their most important function is as head of the Department of Public Instruction. That's the large education agency that oversees a lot of the implementation of programs that are approved by the General Assembly or regulations that are approved by the State Board of Education. So that is the most important function of the superintendent, is to oversee that agency. And doing so also gives them quite the soapbox. The media always seeks out the superintendent and when there are opportunities to weigh in on certain policy matters. And so the superintendent definitely has a very visible role in the media.
That is fascinating, because your description implies that it's really an administrative office in terms of running the operations of the Department of Public Instruction, which is a vast, big agency. But yet it's a non-voting member of the Board of Education, which sets policy. So does that make then for kind of a rough relationship, so to speak?
Well, it certainly has, as long as Mark Johnson was the superintendent of public instruction. And Mark decided not to run for reelection and instead vied for the lieutenant governor nomination on the Republican side and did not do so successfully. There was a contentious relationship between Mark and the members of the State Board of Education, so much so that they went to court to sort it all out. And unfortunately, the courts didn't give us much of an answer about who is ultimately responsible for some of the functions in public schools. It did clarify a few of the human resources issues that were at issue between the superintendent and the State Board of Education. But the shortly after the courts released their decision about the lawsuit, basically both sides declared victory. And that's how we knew that we really hadn't gotten any answers about whether there was any clarity about who was in charge, because both the superintendent and the chair of the State Board of Education said the courts basically said that we won. And so we're still stuck in ground zero, basically, as far as trying to determine who exactly is in charge of North Carolina public schools.
Fair to say, then, that the relationship that the superintendent develops with those members of the State Board of Education is really critical as to whether or not the person who is the superintendent actually has an impact on policy decisions?
Well, it doesn't need to be an amicable relationship, because if the superintendent believes that the state board is acting incorrectly, they should speak up. And in fact, one of the things that I've criticized the State Board of Education for, and this has been happening for decades, is that everyone seems to agree on every issue and all the votes seem to be unanimous and no one speaks up and objects to some of the policies that are proposed. And Superintendent Johnson was willing to do that. And although he was criticized for that, I see that as a very positive thing, because we should have voices of dissent. especially when there are important issues at stake. And of course, the public schools are a 1.5 million student system, and there, of course, are tremendously important issues at stake. And so I really do applaud Superintendent Johnson for speaking up when he found that the State Board of Education was perhaps not acting in the best interest of children.
Okay, Terry, so I'm going to give you a bit of power here as you and I are talking. Let's say that you have been chosen to be the host and moderator of a debate between the two candidates for the superintendent's position. That would be the Democrat, Jen Mangrum, and the Republican, Catherine Truitt. What would be a key question that you would ask both of those candidates?
Well, I would definitely start with school choice, because Dr. Mangrum has made it clear that she is not necessarily a fan of private school choice or charter schools. And so as the head of the Department of Public Instruction, which has the responsibility of overseeing North Carolina's charter schools, I would like to know what she plans on doing with that office to basically fulfill the duties of oversight for the state's charter schools. So that would definitely be one. Teachers, how she plans on making the profession of teaching through the Department of Public Instruction more attractive to basically those who are in universities and from out of state. So I think I would probably start with those two issues.
Any particular issue or question that you would ask Catherine Truitt, who is the Republican candidate?
Yeah, definitely what she plans on doing in reforming the state's Read to Achieve program. This is the third grade reading proficiency a program that has seen better days, that has been under fire for many years.
And again, the two candidates, Democrat Jen Mangrum and Republican Catherine Truitt. Thank you, Terry.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.